Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, as we bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. Today is Thursday, June 17th, 2021. Good afternoon, Dave.
Hello, Melody.
Hello, hello, hello. What a day it has been in the special precious metals markets, for sure. And, you know, it's interesting. I didn't have a chance. I don't know if we're going to talk about it later. But you know what? Commodities all across the world were hit. And I think it's just a matter of, you know, when one sector drops, everything drops. And so we'll be talking about that. So, yes, we got hit today in gold and silver. Still follow through from the comments from Jerome Powell. And so you had gold. Interesting, 1776. How about that? 1776 today. Still trading in the New York spot price aftermarket. Down 36 bucks today. And so it was it was up. It was stronger this morning. Silver, same kind of a day, 26.12. And again, it traded positive earlier in the day. Platinum was down $58, a little over 5%. Now the white metals really got hammered. Platinum was down 5%, 58 bucks at 1,066. Palladium down almost 11%. If anybody is holding palladium, you better be getting rid of it. I can't believe if anybody is holding palladium that you hadn't sold by now and converted it into something else, converted it even into platinum. So if you're in it, 2,586 for platinum, down $296. The USDX, of course, is stronger, 91.94. Crude oil was down. It was actually down $2 earlier in the day, and that came back. It's down only 99 cents at 71.16. So that also came back. And let's see, the paper markets today. Where are the paper markets? The Dow loses 200 points. 33,823. Supposedly there was a Fed policy update. You got that, Dave? The update?
I'm not sure what that might be referring to. I mean, the overnight repo rates went up a 0.5%, but we knew that yesterday.
Yeah.
I'm not seeing anything on the lines, on my lines anyway.
The S&P was down just 1.84, 4,221. NASDAQ was up 121 at 14,161, excuse me. And the bond market, you have the 10-year yield down 1.514%. Europe was a mix. DAX up, FTSE down. France was up. Asia markets, kind of the same thing. The Nikkei was down. You had the Shanghai and the Hang Seng higher. And, you know, it's just all kinds of, just really all kinds of strange things going on today. And, it's, you know, again, it's back to what Jerome Powell said yesterday. And I'm going back to what Greenspan said. It's not what the Fed does. It's what they say. And that's exactly what happened yesterday. It brought a large part of the, you know, because they're going to seek inflation. So they're going to hit the commodities to kind of reflect that that's not going to be a problem. But, Dave, what I really think happened, they really needed a stronger dollar, and I was wondering if it wasn't beginning to really show signs of breaking down even more so, to the point where they had to say something so they could show a stronger dollar.
Well,
they needed it.
That could be. Certainly, to the extent there was any widespread concern about El Salvador's recent comments, which we'll talk about later on this segment. I mean, that could have had an effect to try and reinforce the value of the dollar to make that Bitcoin frenzy go away.
Can we go there now and then go back to the top where the World Bank, where the World Bank said no to El Salvador on Bitcoin? The World Bank has rejected the government of El Salvador's request to help the country implement Bitcoin as legal tender. Bitcoin is not going to be legal tender. It's just not going to happen. The international lender's rejection could hamper the country's goal of making the digital currency accepted across the country within the 3 months. We discussed this last week. El Salvador's legislature became the first in the world to vote in favor of formally adopting Bitcoin, with plans to use it alongside the U.S. dollar, the nation's official currency. Now, I wouldn't think El Salvador is, you know, a country that we really need to worry about. But I also would think El Salvador is a very corrupt, as all nations seem to be anymore, but a little more corrupt than others. So, yeah, they would probably favor adopting the Bitcoin because, again, that has that element of criminal
darkness
aspect to it. You know, a lot of money laundering and things that can be bought and purchased and, you know, without the eyes of the world. So to see a country like El Salvador trying to accept it, kind of brings into question as to why they would be pushing for this, except if it was not a good thing, Dave. But they did ask the World Bank for technical assistance in implementing the cryptocurrency.
Yeah, they did. I mean, Zelaya, the president, said government officials had also talked with the IMF, which he said was not against the plans. However, a World Bank spokesperson did confirm that El Salvador approached them for assistance on Bitcoin, but said it couldn't directly help given the environmental and transparency shortcomings of Bitcoin. Spokesperson added, "We are committed to helping El Salvador in numerous ways, including for currency transparency and regulatory processes." An IMF spokesperson said last week, actually, that adoption of Bitcoin as legal tender raises a number of macroeconomic, financial, and legal issues, not the least of which are those Melody just mentioned, that require very careful analysis. I'd say so far, so good, Melody.
Hey, the banks, governments aren't going to allow, the central banks are not going to allow a cryptocurrency. Not now. It's not going to happen. So, you know, they're not going to allow a cryptocurrency to compete with the world reserve currency that's fiat. It's not going to happen. So, not unless until they're ready to happen, and they've got a good thing going. Why would they ruin it now? So, not going to happen. Well, anyway, Dave, after yesterday's Fed meeting, the initial jobless claims unexpectedly rose last week. Well, this is all despite this good, strong, ongoing recovery that we have. Of course, these are the numbers, according to the Labor Department. First-time filings for unemployment insurance for the week ending June 12th totaled 412,000, compared to the previous weeks of 375,000. Now, again, this is the highest number since going back to May 15th. And, everyone was expecting 360. So they were expecting 360 and got 412. Now they're looking at two states to which the most of the increase came from, which I find odd, but Pennsylvania and California. Interesting. So the surprise increase in claims comes following a series of monthly incremental steps towards normalcy in payroll. A year ago at this time, the nation was seeing close to 1.5 million new claims a week. And, of course, that was as everything was being shut down. We're beginning to see improvement, but certainly not enough to support claims of our recovery in the economy, Dave.
Yeah, indeed. Now, these continuing claims, which run a week behind the headline number, were little changed at just shy of 3.5 million. A year ago, you might recall that number was just about 18 million. Four-week moving average for continuing claims fell by 55,000 to just over 3.6 million. That's the lowest since March 21st last year. Now, yesterday, again, Fed Chair Powell noted the difficulties in getting workers back to filling the record 9.3 million available jobs, saying factors related to the pandemic, I know I have to work on my imitation there, such as caregiving needs,
well, you
ongoing...
You better, because I'm getting yelling down.
I know you are. Ongoing fears of the virus and unemployment insurance payments appear to be weighing on employment growth. And he added these factors should wane in coming months against the backdrop of rising vaccinations leading to more rapid gains in employment, blah, 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 blah. Now, the total amount of folks receiving jobless benefits fell under 15 million to 14.8 as of the end of May. And that's a reduction of more than a half million. And that's come largely due to a sharp decline in those enrolled in pandemic-related programs, particularly as now a majority of states have discontinued the enhanced benefits provided by Washington. The Fed noted both progress in the labor market and rising inflationary pressures, as it indicated the first wave of interest rate increases might come sooner than expected, pointed to two-quarter point hikes by the end of 2023. I'll be talking more about this, in particular Jerome Powell's misplaced optimism at the end of today's program, Melody.
Well, you know, the Philadelphia Fed's monthly manufacturing is it's seen as one of the first monthly indicators of the health of the United States, and manufacturing leading up to the national report by the Institute for Supply Management that's due out July 1st. So this separate economic report today reflects a struggling expansion and, of course, the ongoing price pressures of the recent months. The Philadelphia's Fed Monthly Manufacturing Survey registered a reading of 30.7. Now, that's a little slightly higher than what was expected, which was 30, but it is lower than the month before. So any reading that is above zero indicates expansion in the region's manufacturing. Now, the region covers, the survey covers factories in eastern Pennsylvania, southern New Jersey, and Delaware. Well, that might make sense for maybe the unemployment claims being higher in Pennsylvania. I don't know. But so it's interesting that we've seen these factories struggling to keep up with demand in recent months as we do see the economy. And it is showing signs of emerging. I mean, heck, if you have everything shut down, what would you expect? You are going to see... numbers go up from zero to on up. And the Philly Fed's factory activity gauge hit its highest level since April of 1973, back in March. So increases in both the employment prices paid helped keep the index elevated last month, though again it was a point lower than the prior month. The gauge of new orders fell 10 points, while the shipments index rose 6 points. Unfilled orders fell to 22.45 from 40.4 in May. So I guess that's a good sign. The prices paid index rose to 80.7. That's the highest level going back to 1979. And again, you know, all of these numbers should be compared to 2019, not to last year. You know, because, I mean, again, Dave, everything was shut down. So, I mean, you know, what do these numbers show? Growth? But, of course, why wouldn't it show growth after the world has been shut down? But really, as far as long as we are, it should probably show much stronger numbers than what we're getting, I think. Do you agree, Dave?
Do I agree? Yes, sure. I mean, on the face of it, it's a function of logic. I mean, it's, as you said, you start with zero, you know, in a rebound, much less a recovery, there's nowhere to go but up.
Nowhere to go but up. Well, you know, we talked about how the Fed had dominated the headlines yesterday and today, and there's plenty more to digest from central banks around the world. European Central Bank chief economist Philip Lane, for one, he signaled that the bank may keep stimulus in place longer than many expect. Specifically, he said that September may be too soon to start discussing shifting away from the current ultra-loose monetary policy. The executive board member pushed back against the perception that the ECB will likely consider how to unwind its monetary stimulus soon as the economy rebounds and inflation accelerates. He said he noted that we're not necessarily going to have every piece of hard data you want to have going into that September meeting. And the comments by Lane, who writes the ECB's monetary policy proposals, suggest that officials may find the euro's areas economic outlook just too uncertain to take their foot off the stimulus pedal. And it's just not Europe. It's the U.S. too. We just talk a different game. Euro households and businesses are still reliant on support, as here. Some officials are warning about inflationary pressures. He says he sees few signs of this translating into higher wages and creating an upward spiral of prices. Any inflation, I'm sure he'll come out soon and say it's just transitory, right?
Yeah.
Hey, we're heading into the break already. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSCTalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with Dave Allen. And I'm just trying to fix my mic a little bit here, so maybe I was a little distracted there. But welcome back to the program. And 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. Take advantage of these lower prices now that silver's dropped $2, basically, from 28 to 26. Premiums are still high. They didn't change, but you're still saving $2 an ounce. That's pretty nice. So give us a call at 800-375-4188. And I think I'm going to have some sort of a brief lesson on how things are priced, because everybody expects, because we saw a $2 drop in silver, that the premiums would be really, really low, that the price of Silver Eagles would be really, really low. No, you still have the middleman in there. His prices didn't change. And that's the bulk of what you're paying over spot, is that wholesale price, is the middleman's price. And there's two of them in there that you have to take care of when you're buying the American Eagle series before you get to the retail price, which is my price. My price has stayed the same. It hasn't gone up, hasn't gone down. It's always been, you know, right where it all, even, you know, when the wholesale premiums weren't so large as they are. So there is a difference. So a lot of people expect, because it dropped to 26, that you're going to be able to buy Silver Eagles at $30 again. No, that's not the case. You're seeing a $2 correction prices. So if you were paying, so if the prices were $40, now they're $38. Actually, I think they're a little bit lower than that. But so give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. You know, we have every week, Dave works hard on his Levity is Golden. And I think this is kind of interesting. I'm not sure if it's good. It sounds like it would be. But I just don't know, Dave. You know, I'm...
We'll see, and it's healthy to be skeptical about this.
You know, and I think this is... go ahead. So, yeah, it's interesting. So, go ahead. It's about energy, Dave. Go tell us about it.
Well, I do have to admit, I'm not crazy about this particular angle of this topic, because it happens to involve billionaire Jeff Bezos, who neither of us is a big fan of, but the topic is important and potentially affects everyone on the planet. A nuclear fusion startup, financially backed by Bezos, will build its first pilot power plant outside of London, potentially accelerating a new way of generating lots of clean energy and cheaper energy. Whether it'll be too cheap to meter, I strongly doubt that. But Canada's General Fusion Corporation is one of about two dozen startups trying to harness the power that makes stars shine. Rather than splitting atoms like in traditional nuclear fission reactors, fusion plants seek to bind them together at temperatures 10 times hotter than the sun. Whoa. That would leave a significant scar, Melody. Doing so releases huge quantities of carbon-free energy with no atomic waste that needs to be stored for eternity. Now, in current fusion designs, lasers and powerful electromagnets are placed around a super-cooled donut-shaped container to hold superheated plasma in place that's used to fuse the atoms. General fusion's machine takes a radically different approach. Its magnetized target fusion reactor compresses a hydrogen target surrounded by a swirling wall of molten metal. Gosh, how I wish I had paid attention in Mr. Wilson's chemistry class way back when. About 500 synchronized pistons that encompass a cylinder fire at a rate of 6 to 60 shots per minute. Heat from the plasma is then transferred into the metal, where it can then be channeled to turbines that produce power. Now, the massive future fusion reactors envisioned by ITER in France can generate more than 1,000 megawatts of electricity each. That's a lot. General Fusion's machines, however, will produce just 115 megawatts of power, not enough energy to light up a large city, but more than enough to stabilize our grids that are filled with intermittent solar and wind power. Now, not all physicists agree that smaller fusion reactors like the one General Fusion's building will generate the most cost-efficient energy for consumers. But scientists acknowledge that private investors are helping to balance pure research against commercial opportunity. International Atomic Energy Agency Director Rafael Mariano Grossi said, "It's time to dispel the idea that fusion is an academic endeavor in pursuit of an energy unicorn. We can see this now around the corner. We are approaching this moment fast." Well, Melody, I'm not sure where it leads, who's going to end up owning it, and how much and to what extent it will benefit us versus any kinds of risks out there. But perhaps we are closer to a new era of energy production than maybe we thought. And that's the bottom line of this week's Levity is Golden.
Yeah, like I said, I guess anything can be good. But again, I think that the, you know, it's usually, the people that end up paying for it, and I guess if it helps our grid, that's fine. But I would think, what if something goes wrong with it?
All I'm thinking of is Back to the Future.
I'm thinking of temperatures 10 times hotter than the sun.
Well, that could,
you know, so if this escapes,
that could leave quite some disaster in its path.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. I don't think it's as close as to what you might think, but we'll see. We need to follow up on that story and maybe learn a little bit more about it. So, you know, yesterday.
I was just going to say, we'll be back to you in another 10 years, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, you know, yesterday we talked about the infrastructure, you know, if it was even going to be, you know, coming around soon or whatever. So now we have 11 Republican senators support. They're supporting a bipartisan infrastructure framework, and that might be enough for a potential bill to get through the chamber if all skeptical Democrats back it. Yesterday, there was a statement. A combined 21 Democratic and GOP senators endorsed roughly a $1 trillion proposal that wouldn't raise taxes on corporations or wealthy individuals. The bipartisan plan would revamp transportation, broadband, and water, but would not meet any Democrats' goals for investment in clean energy and social programs. In a joint statement, the senator said, "We look forward to working with our Republican Democrat colleagues to develop legislation based on this framework to address America's critical infrastructure challenges." So now this proposal serves as the last effort to strike a bipartisan infrastructure deal before the Democrats move to pass legislation on their own. I can't imagine that they would go along with it, but a smaller bipartisan group of 10 senators who initially drafted the plan has tried to win support on Capitol Hill, but has not yet earned the blessings of the congressional leaders or the White House. So, you know, a handful of senators have threatened to vote against the bipartisan deal. If any Democrats oppose the plan, more than 10 Republicans would need to back it for it to hit the filibuster-proof 60-vote threshold to pass legislation in the Senate. So I don't know, Dave. You know, it's not going to get done that easy.
I don't know. Like I said yesterday, the window is fairly narrow. It's clear this is the top priority of the administration. They really just have until the end of July, for the most part, to get this done, because there'll be the August congressional recess. And then again, when they come back in September, people's attentions are going to be focused toward fundraising for next year's midterm elections, and I think all bets are off. And already today, Chuck Schumer, Senate Majority Leader, announced that, you know, he's asked the Senate Budget Committee, headed by Bernie Sanders, to forge ahead in developing, doing its early work on developing a 2022 budget. So how that will sort of make things difficult with infrastructure now, especially in a bipartisan sense, I guess that remains to be seen. I'm just not so sure that with all the uncertainty, things are going to get done. I do hear, and I heard two Republican senators on TV this morning say how, and these are two that are up for election next year, who said how important they thought an infrastructure bill was to their states. So that complicates the calculus for leaders like McConnell in the Senate, McCarthy in the House, who may be more averse to cooperating with the White House on this. So. What do we have? 6 weeks, roughly, until August. We'll see if they can get it done, or if all the distractions are going to just prevent it from happening, Melody.
I think the most astounding thing that you said in all that was in just 6 weeks. It's going 6 weeks. It's going to be August. It's like, oh my gosh.
I know, that's like, oh man, I'm sorry I brought that up.
I know, geez, that's all I could focus on, 6 weeks. That means it's only six more months till Christmas. Oh my.
Hold off the summer solstice.
Well, you know, we have so many problems with supplies and the supply chain was broken during last year's world shutdown. Now, China is really having some issues. China's busiest ports, one of China's busiest ports, announced it wouldn't accept new export containers in late May because of the outbreak. It was supposed to be up and running again in a few days, but as the partial shutdown drags on, it's further snarling trade routes and lifting record freight prices even higher. There are now a reported 139 container vessels that are anchored off the coast of China. That's about 50% more than the recent average. The port now says it will be back to normal by the end of June, but we know it took several weeks for ship schedules and supply chains to recover from the vessels that was blocking the Suez Canal in March. So it could actually take months for the cargo backlog in southern China to clear, while the fallout is going to ripple to ports all around the world. So this trend is worrying, and unceasing congestion is becoming a global problem. Mahler Maersk, the world's number one container carrier, said today. POCUS, a shipping software firm, Flexport, said the situation in South China is another in a string of disasters we've seen plague the global supply chain. And
yeah, that's pretty interesting. I mean, this guy estimates that the congestion in this port will take 6 to 8 weeks to clear. And I suppose that just his institutional bias makes that an optimistic assessment. In any event, that timetable is a problem because it extends the disruptions into the late summer, early fall period of peak demand from the U.S. and Europe. And that's when retailers and other importers restock warehouses ahead of the December holiday shopping rush. So usually cheap and invisible to companies and consumers, ocean freight that's now more expensive than ever has become a double-edged threat to the world economy. It's acting as both a drag on commerce and a potential accelerant for inflation. The Fed raised their inflation forecast yesterday partly because bottlenecks have formed as supply fails to keep pace with this unprecedented consumer demand. Drewry Shipping released data today showing no let-up as container rates on several routes keep climbing, including an increase to over $11,000 for a 40-foot box to Rotterdam from Shanghai. Listen to this, 7 times higher than it was a year ago.
Wow.
So, yeah, while the situation at the Chinese port is said to be improving, there's still an average waiting time of over 2 weeks, 16 days, which is diverting most ships elsewhere. So, and what's that likely to do? Create congestions at delays at those other nearby ports.
Hmm.
Whew. Makes you wonder, you wonder how things work behind the scenes, if some of this perhaps isn't, a plan of China to maybe further disrupt prices and what have you, commerce in general in the Western world.
That's true. That's true. We haven't heard, we hear a little bit about Iran, but in a fascinating twist, or maybe even ironically, Iran hardline former president has accused the U.S. of meddling in the Middle East. This is no surprise, as citizens there prepare to vote in elections tomorrow. Everybody meddles in everybody's elections. I don't think it's anything new, But we have Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said in the 2015 nuclear deal caused more problems than it resolved and cast doubt on the legitimacy of the country's impending election. Any decision that prevents the people from influencing the outcome is against the spirit of the revolution and the Constitution, he says. And we haven't heard his name around for a while.
Yeah.
But he said the comments come from the former president's candidacy was rejected by Iran's Guardian Council. That's right. He was going to run.
Yeah.
He was going to run again. I remember reading that, but now it was rejected. He can't be that. The vetting body of Supreme Leader Ayatollah al-Khamenei, the move essentially barred him from running in this year's election.
Oh, sour.
It's not going to bar us from going into the break, Dave.
Darn.
We'll be right back. Please stay tuned.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on Shortwave Radio, Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time, welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Melody's spending the final segment in the office taking care of clients. Call her at 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Now, at the top of the program today, Melody mentioned the rising prices of commodities around the world. Interestingly, the theft of commodities. Gentlemen, my apologies. Talking about theft of commodities. That Melody alluded to in the top of the program, such as lumber, copper, and other metals and food crops. Well, it's nothing new, yet the combination of soaring prices, the pandemic, and the hit to economies has created an unusually fertile ground for criminals. Statistics are hard to come by because authorities use different data, and much of it's from before the pandemic took hold, and frankly, it's believed a lot of the crime goes unreported by victims. But interviews, that's in some parts of the world, but interviews with experts, law enforcement agencies, and victims who do report paint a picture of a spike in criminal activity as the jump in commodity prices fuels talk of another super cycle like the one that happened in the early 2000s. In Chile, for example, where the price of copper is tracked by bankers and taxi drivers alike because of its economic importance, gangs target freshly smelted stacks of the metal as it travels on rail cars. There are reports out of Germany, the UK, and the US of catalytic converters in cars being harvested for their gold, silver, copper, and other metals. In Nigeria, which like many developing countries is suffering from runaway inflation and food prices, some farmers complain that thieves are targeting their crops. Then there's what's known as food fraud, which can mean adulterating food or replacing it with an inferior product, even faking its origin. In Malaysia, some criminals are repackaging used cooking oil in tins or painted bottles to pass it off as palm oil, a staple that's become a lot more costly. In India, at least 500 people fell ill in April after consuming adulterated buckwheat flour. Of course, in the U.S., lumber prices have soared to an all-time high and are now more than double what they were a year ago, even though they did fall last week. Copper's up 70% over the same period, having also hit a record last month. Global food prices increased for a 12th straight month in May to the highest in almost a decade. And while soaring prices have provided an incentive for commodity-related crime, the pandemic has furnished fresh opportunities. disruptions to supplies and reduced availability of some materials means supply managers must at times resort to doing business with previously untested suppliers. Because of complex supply chains, products change hands several times, often across borders, before they arrive on supermarket shelves. Capitalism and the profit motive, ladies and gentlemen. Who cares about the means, right? Jeez. Well, let's next dive into today's Wall Street on Parade from our friends Pam and Russ Martin. Last month, it was reported that the Department of Justice had opened an investigation into Archegos Capital Management and its bank lenders. Listeners, you'll recall that Archegos is the family office hedge fund run by billionaire Bill Huang that had blown up in late March, causing more than $10 billion in losses to too-big-to-fail banks like Credit Suisse, UBS, Morgan Stanley, and others. Archegos had obtained leverage of as much as 85% on its heavily concentrated stock trades from some of its banks, in brazen violation of the Fed's regulations, which sets margins for stock trading at a maximum of 50% on opening trades. In addition, the banks were holding the stocks in their own names while shifting losses and gains to Archegos under a derivatives contract called a swap, thus denying the public the knowledge of the true owners of these stock positions. This bogus derivative contract accomplished two other things as well. It allowed the bank to avoid the Volcker rule that bans them from owning a hedge fund while still letting them loan out their balance sheet to a hedge fund and collect lucrative fees along the way. It's crazy. And it allowed the banks to ignore their own internal broker-dealer rules on making margin loans against concentrated stock positions. There's also the compelling question of just who, if anyone, was paying the capital gains taxes on these stock trades. In late March, when Archegos couldn't meet its risky margin calls with the banks had to panic sell the stocks they were holding, pushing down the prices of stocks like Viacom, CBS, and GameStop, in some cases by as much as 50%. Well, the Department of Justice can bring criminal prosecutions, while the SEC can only bring civil cases. Thus, when justice gets involved, Wall Street traders pay attention. That's been particularly true since September 2019, when the Justice Department criminally charged two current and one former trader, J.P. Morgan Chase, with turning the precious metals market desk at the bank into a racketeering enterprise. It strikes the Martins and us too as perhaps more than a coincidence that less than 3 weeks after the news broke that the Justice Department was investigating the structure of trading between Archegos and the banks, that three of the biggest banks have announced that trading revenues are going to be down substantially in the second quarter. J.P. Morgan Chase, revenues off 38%, they predict. Citigroup says it could see a decline of 30%. Morgan Stanley, which has already acknowledged its role in lending to Archegos, says it would take a $911 million loss from the debacle. When will they learn, ladies and gentlemen, that crime doesn't pay? Or is that the point, that they don't have to learn, perhaps because none of them is going to go to jail? It's disgusting. Now, to bring in the weekend, I'm an optimist at heart when it comes to life in general and to people and their intentions in particular. I've paid for that in some cases over the years, but I am who I am and it is what it is. But since joining DGS Coins 4 years ago, I've learned that more important than sheer optimism and trusting others is telling the truth. And that's what we in Financial Survival try to do each and every day to you, our loyal listeners. Truth is always going to trump an optimistic outlook here every time. And so when we say we know that the fundamentals of gold and silver are still strong and that they in physical form are the only investments that are a true store of value, we also have to tell you that the precious metals market is being manipulated like never before. More traditional paper investors, especially large institutional types, are investing in gold and silver ETFs like they have haven't ever before. And their dangerous algorithm-driven trading practices are making gold and silver prices more volatile and uncertain than ever. Case in point, investors were relieved on the one hand that yesterday that the Fed may act to keep the market from getting more overheated, and on the other, they're more skittish about the pending removal of the punch bowl, even if the punch bowl's here to stay for another 2 years. The signals that Jerome Powell sent yesterday point to a Fed that's increasingly willing to contemplate a pullback from the emergency market support that began last spring in reaction to the pandemic. But again, he said, don't expect these changes to happen anytime soon. The updated dot plot of Fed member sentiment indicates a medium expectation of 225 basis point rate hikes by the end of 2023, up from zero. That would take the Fed funds rate to a whopping 0.5%. Oh boy, things are looking down. Okay, so the Fed might actually begin discussing the timeline to taper its $120 billion per month asset purchases at its next meeting on July 27-28. Emphasis on might, but there still won't be any tapering until December or the beginning of next year at the earliest. And the Fed, again, still isn't likely to hike interest rates for 2 years. And even after rates are eventually raised to 0.5%, the real Fed funds rate, after accounting for the government's absurd undercounted inflation rate, will be negative for the foreseeable future. So all this makes yesterday's Fed announcements and Powell's pronouncements inherently anticlimactic. It doesn't really matter. The big picture remains exactly what we knew it would be. No change to anything. Now, like me, is an optimist. He was an optimist long before the recession, expressing the view that unemployment could continually fall without necessarily triggering an unpleasant rise in inflation. Well, the new Fed framework of waiting to see actual realized inflation could be seen as formalizing his approach to that optimism. Regardless, when it comes to the risks right in front of us, it's clear he's more worried about an inflation overshoot than he is about employment. In his first answer at yesterday's press conference, he sounded unambiguously confident that the economy will return to a state of low employment. And whatever issues we're facing now with slow non-farm payroll growth are the result of temporary factors. Transitory, just like inflation. I mean, the temporary factors for employment, well, ongoing fears of the virus, lack of childcare, possibly enhanced jobless benefits, whatever. At other times throughout the press conference, he reiterated his view that on the jobs front, he's just not worried. He's aware that the labor market isn't healed, but we'll get there. Powell's also optimistic about inflation. He cited various, again, transitory factors, supply chains and so forth, to explain the current upward pressure. And he even cited the recent tumble in lumber prices as evidence that markets work and self-correct. Well, we'll see what happens next month. But he clearly sees some possibility that inflation could become a problem if current elevated levels change people's expectations, which I believe they already have. Overall, Powell's optimistic that unemployment will rapidly come down along with inflation. But of the two, he said, he and it would appear several other members of the Federal Open Market Committee are edging more towards monitoring the risk of inflation becoming problematic than the risk of labor market running out of steam before the Fed's ever ambiguous full employment goals are met. Hey, before they're met, why don't you tell us what it is? Define it for us. It's so gosh darn vague, obscure, probably by design. Optimism. There's always light at the end of the tunnel, right? But remember the warning of the late great humorist Will Rogers, who said, even if you're on the right track, you'll get run over if you're just sitting there. Now that, ladies and gentlemen, is telling the truth. Now that's about all the time we have for today's show. I'm going to be back next Tuesday. Melody will be here tomorrow. Butch is making his rounds back to West Virginia, and he'll be back, I believe, on Monday. Also, be on the lookout for our weekly What a Rush of Gold and Silver blog in your email boxes tomorrow. Thanks for listening. It's been a lot of fun. It's always an honor bringing you the news and commentary of the day. Have a good evening, and please be safe out there. Bye-bye.
And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.